Hi, and welcome to this audio commentary on Margaret, the Extended Cut, the 2011 movie directed by Kenneth Lonergan. My name is Rob Caravaggio, robcaravaggio.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to synchronize your copy of Margaret to this audio commentary, we'll give you a countdown in just a moment to help you do that. In the meantime, what you can do is locate the very start of the movie. We're watching a Region 1 DVD, and the extended cut of the movie, I believe, is only available on DVD. They put the Blu-ray on, they put the theatrical version, rather, on a Blu-ray. And when they made the extended cut available, I believe in all regions, it's only out there on DVD. But I could be wrong about that. But at least in Region 1 here in the States, I think it should only be on a DVD disc. And so we're watching, once again, the extended cut. And just as that Fox Searchlight Pictures logo fades entirely to black, just after that logo, hit pause on your DVD. Well, you wouldn't have Blu-ray. Hit pause on your DVD. And that will allow us all momentarily to hit play together and watch the movie in perfect synchronized harmony. All right, if you've taken a moment to find that sync point just after the Fox Searchlight Pictures logo has faded to black, it looks like it's about 25 seconds in to the DVD where I have it paused, but that might vary depending on what you're working with. So, I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, play. That'll be your cue to hit play along with me. Just briefly, I've misplaced my remote control, and I normally use that to start the movie, so I need to get out of my chair to hit the button on the player. So you'll hear my voice a little faint in the background, and I'll try to amplify it in post, but I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, play. That'll be your cue to hit play. Also, I'm going to try and leave the audio on the movie very, very faint in the background, so you might hear it to help you sync up. So I'm going to get up, and you'll hear me say 3, 2, 1, play. Okay, ready? 3, 2, 1, play. All right. Sorry about the commotion there. The Camelot Pictures logo is on the screen. Okay, and sorry about that. I just wanted to make sure my audio wasn't too loud. Some folks like to, some folks who write in tell me that they sometimes like hearing the audio of the movie in the background, which I haven't normally done, but some folks like it, some folks don't. So I'm going to try recording commentaries with it on a little bit in the background and some with it off and see how they go over. See which one I prefer, anyway. These opening shots of New York City are very characteristic, and that music you're hearing, the music was changed by Lonergan in many ways when the movie was recut for his version. There's a whole history to this movie that I'm going to go into. I'm a big proponent of this movie, and I'll try to explain why. Matt Damon's credit just left the screen if you're trying to sync up. I really think it's poignant the way Lonergan at the outset gives us these sort of slow motion shots of they are very characteristic of New York City. Just the hustle and bustle and of Manhattan, people are always going somewhere. People are always passing each other by. And slowing it down in this way is really incredible. Incredibly poignant. Now, let me start, before I even get into things, we have a nice long movie ahead of us. Let me start by giving a little bit. There's Anthony Minghella's credit as executive producer. The movie was produced by Scott Rudin, Sidney Pollack, Anthony Minghella, and some other producers. A lot of people had their hands in this pie, and I'm going to talk about the good things that come from that and maybe the liabilities of it. Kenneth Lonergan's credit as writer and director is now on the screen as the credit sequence has now switched to this shot of a Manhattan skyline. We're now in Lisa Cohen's classroom, and there's Paquin playing Lisa. There's a slightly more youthful Matt Damon playing Mr. Aaron, and that's a good way to start talking about the history of this movie. This movie was released theatrically. I saw it in 2012 when it finally made its way to theaters. It had a long road. Lonergan, I think in 2000 is when he directed, and Lonergan was a drama guy, a New York drama guy, and still is a theater guy. And in, I believe it was 2000, he made a movie with Mark Ruffalo and Laura Linney that was very, very good. And it was called You Can Count on Me. And I really enjoy that movie. I really like Laura Linney. And Ruffalo is more of an acquired taste, I guess. But I like him, too. I thought he was a good Incredible Hulk, for one thing. But Lonergan directed that movie, and it sort of went over well with critics, and it didn't do poorly. And so he was furnished with the opportunity to make another movie. This movie started its pre-production and filming in the early aughts. So Margaret is very much a post 9/11 movie. If you're listening to this, I presume that you've at least seen it. You should not see it while you listen to me, at least the first time, but you may have seen only the theatrical cut and are curious about the what I call the Lonergan cut, and I'll explain why I am precise with my language there as we go on. But why don't I go ahead and start with the background of this? Anyway, that's what I started to do. Lonergan did You Can Count on Me, went over well with critics, it went over well with audiences. It was kind of a nice adult drama, and Laura Linney, I think, got nominated for some awards in it. And he started pre-production, sort of post 9/11, and filming this movie in the early. You can see how much in the early aughts, and you can see how much younger Anna Paquin is in this movie than she is on True Blood. She sort of seems way older. She's still very youthful looking. Always liked her as an actor too. Here she is. If you're trying to sync up, she's smoking a cigarette on screen right now with her two buddies. Her, as the movie goes on, her the sort of friends, her peers, sort of start to look older. Her idiot teacher here is now talking to her as she stares sort of blankly at him. These sort of people who are one of the themes in the movie, I think, is people who are blinded to a whole other way of thinking or a whole other way of living or a whole other way of experiencing life. And the while I might agree with the more left-wing spin that these particular teachers in her sort of well-to-do high school Lisa Cohen's well-to-do high school, while I might tend to agree with a lot of the sort of left-wing spin that they put on history or that they seem to be putting on history, I find that as a pedagogical approach, it's kind of silly, and I think that's part of Lonergan's point with some of this, is that often you have people who are just blinded to other ways of experiencing, other ways of thinking, and it in the movie you'll find that it makes them struggle to understand other people and struggle to really communicate with other people. And one thing I noticed in the movie, too, the first time I saw it, and it comes out in that scene as we see Peter Gallagher Jr. on the screen now with Lisa Cohen, or with Paquin, walking down this nice, that's a nice New York shot, too, of sort of looks like Manhattan. looks like a, well, never mind the neighborhood. Most people listening to this don't give a shit about what neighborhood in Manhattan that is, but it's a very nice neighborhood. It looks like it's near Central Park almost. I don't know, I can't see what the cross streets are. But anyway, yeah, I think those teachers kind of set up one of the things Lonergan does in this movie, which is children kind of, or kids, younger people, acting like simple-minded adults, simple-minded versions of adults, and adults often acting like simple-minded versions of kids. And I think the teachers and the relationships between the teachers and the students in this movie kind of demonstrates that in a way. I'll explain more what I mean by that. But let me first, I always sidetrack myself, and I apologize. I try to, as much as I can, as people, listeners seem to appreciate as much as I can, me sticking to what's on the screen as much as possible. It helps people sync up, and it just kind of makes more sense. But with a movie that's very complex like this, has a lot of complex stories, I find that I have to zoom out, zoom in a lot of times. So sometimes there's not an elegant way to do it, especially if there's something very important going on the screen. So I'm doing my best. This was scheduled. Now, it started shooting and filming in the early aughts. And many people pointed out, once again, it is sort of a very post 9/11 movie. And I won't even go into what people may mean by that, but people seem to have a sense for what they mean by that and what other people mean by that. And I think I do too. It's a certain kind of approach to storytelling set in New York City that in too many movies, post 9/11 movies, I think it got a little bit precious and a little bit forced in terms of the poignancy. But by telling a very human story here, I think Lonergan avoids some of that preciousness. He is a theater guy, and so he's a very good, you know, a lot of the dialogue in this movie is just very, very textured and good. It was indeed scheduled for release in 2007. Fox Searchlight, I won't go into the lawsuits with Lonergan suing people and the studio suing and some of the financiers of the movie suing. What happened was Lonergan wanted to make a film snob might call. He wanted to make a real film, and Fox Searchlight, which, you know, often puts out interesting movies by interesting directors, and they're not afraid to take real chances. Often, they had some conditions. It was slated for release in 2007, but Searchlight wanted, and you see all the people who produced the movie. Lonergan had a lot of people sort of on his side, and Scott Rudin, Sidney Pollack, Anthony Minghella was involved. There's Kristen Ritter, sort of goth or emo looking actress who has been on Breaking Bad and now has that show, The Bitch in Apartment 23 or something like that. But, she has that small little part as the shop girl, as Lisa's looking to buy her cowboy hat here. The sort of self-involved ness of her checking her reflection, she's sort of preoccupied with herself. The whole idea of narcissism in contemporary life is really on Lonergan's mind, not just in this movie, but in You Can Count on Me Too. I really like Lonergan when I've heard him speak about stuff and speak about these matters, by the way. I think he's a really smart guy and a really nice man. I didn't meet him, but I was in a small room sort of reception where he was kind of being asked questions and seemed like a very sweet guy. Here's the inciting incident coming up as Ruffalo waves at Paquin. And this is really, I like the editing here. Bringing us inside the bus, outside the bus, his point of view, her point of view. It makes sure that we don't sympathize with either of them necessarily more than the other in terms of this whole situation. Also, the choice of Allison Janney to play Monica Patterson, the woman who is killed and has her leg severed, and we sort of have her point of view there. for a moment as we sort of seem to be looking up from the street. The choice to have a great actor like Allison Janney play this role, I think, is really... I mean, you could go both ways. You could go with an unknown and have a sort of slightly more creepy effect, but you need an actor who's going to be able to pull off this scene, this dying scene here. That's basically her, all she does in the movie, and you need someone who's got the chops to do this. This is very characteristic of what happens when a serious accident happens in Manhattan, by the way. Sort of traffic, it isn't always like this in other cities, but traffic doesn't stop, but people stop, and they come over, and they try to help, and I find that they will sometimes, like this guy in the suit here, they will sometimes get directly involved in a way that I've lived in other cities, and people sometimes don't in other cities. They're hesitant to. Of course, there's a lot of people standing and watching here too, but just the fact that this guy in a suit gets his hands dirty, that Lisa does what she's doing, it's very, very true to New York. The idea that New York is a bunch of assholes is just it's never been true. In terms of the way people, the decent way people treat people, treat other people. The big thing that was the big problem between Lonergan and Fox Searchlight had to do with not so much the content of the movie or what Lonergan was trying to do with the movie, although they had some real problems with, the kind of movie Kenneth Lonergan was making. The real problem was that they wanted a 150-minute movie or less. That was like a non-negotiable, as the studio suits would say. That's a non-negotiable, 150-minute movie or less. And a 150-minute movie, I mean, that's plenty. That's plenty of movie. I love the tension in this scene and the way Lisa kind of yells at people and while at the same time having this powerful moment with Monica Patterson as she dies. And obviously the imagery here is reminiscent of the what's called the Pieta, the Jesus being in the arms of Mary after he's taken off the cross, his corpse. That image is known as the Pieta. Yeah, it's a powerful scene. Anyway, Lonergan couldn't really. There was a lot of back and forth. Once the lawyers got involved with in various ways. There was a whole lot of legal wrangling and back and forth that really went on for years. And this movie was shelved for a good long time. Because of this legal wrangling and back and forth. And they never really settled the differences. Lonergan those involved never really settled amicably. They just kind of found a solution that wasn't completely detestable to Lonergan, because he was, you gotta hand it to the guy. I mean, he was sticking up for the art that he wanted to make. At least that's my perspective. That's from what I can have read of the situation. He seemed to really be standing up for what his intentions were and what he was trying to do. What happened was the 150-minute cut of the movie, roughly 150 minutes. That's a good long movie now. That cut of the movie was approved by Lonergan. Lonergan approved of it. He calls it just as much his vision as the longer cut, in a sense. He's made statements to that effect. He doesn't disavow it in any way. But in addition to the editors who worked on the movie, the way that 150-minute... Because Lonergan's cut, what he turned in to the studio... was the cut of the movie we're watching, this extended cut. That's why I call it the Lonergan cut. It's what he turned in. In order to sort of appease Lonergan, the studio said it's too long. In order to appease Lonergan after a long time wrangling, the solution, part of the solution that was come up with was, and that Lonergan sort of approved of, was, or that was, again, not completely detestable to Lonergan, as Emily says later in this movie, later in Margaret, she says, when she's talking about her friend Monica Patterson, she says, I just want to remember her in a way that would not be completely infuriating to her or something like that. That's also why I keep saying it that way. It's very funny. But what they did was, in order to arrive at a cut that would meet the studio's requirements of roughly 150 minutes or less, and be a cut of the movie that Lonergan could more or less live with, they brought in people to help pare the movie down, and people that Lonergan was, or any filmmaker was, would be sure not to have a problem with. And the people they brought in were Thelma Schoonmaker and Martin Scorsese. Thelma Schoonmaker, of course, longtime collaborator and editor for Scorsese's movies. And she has her talents and her reputation are immense in terms of film editing. And Scorsese, who has a despite his movies sometimes having less than satisfying endings, Scorsese has a real knack for the kind of paring down that they were looking to do. And so the cut of the movie that was the theatrical cut, the cut that I saw when this movie was ultimately released in ultimately made its way to a theater that where I saw it in 2012, that cut was a cut that was overseen and helped shaped by Scorsese and Schoonmaker. And Lonergan calls it his vision, but it wasn't totally his vision. It wasn't what he turned in. And in fact, that theatrical cut, if you go back and watch that cut of the movie, the one that would be available on Blu-ray and DVD, you'll find that there are a lot of story elements and plot points that just don't make sense. And there's a lot of things that seem like purposeful ambiguity that in fact are not purposeful ambiguity, but the result of a kind of impromptu attempt at ambiguity, because certain story elements and whole scenes, and sometimes the middle of scenes, Lonergan writes these long scenes in the screenplay and the original shooting script, and sometimes the middle of a scene, the middle chunk, would just be taken out, like when Lisa has sex with the Kieran Culkin character, Paul. There's a whole kitchen sequence that we only get a bit of in the theatrical cut, and there are other scenes like that that are kind of gutted and made and foreshortened. And the whole thing with Lisa's abortion, for example, in the theatrical cut, we don't even know if she's telling the truth. It just sort of pops out of nowhere. We're as surprised as Mr. Aaron is, and as the gym teacher is, who's accompanying him when Lisa reveals that. But here, in Lonergan's cut, we get the whole thing. Lisa goes, well, we'll get to it, but Lisa goes with her mother, Joan, and she's unsure of the paternity. She reveals that to Joan, and Joan is kind of with her through that ordeal. And we know that, and it also allows us to view the Joan character in a very different way in Lonergan's cut. So at that end scene, we see that her mother has been sort of been there for Lisa in a very important way, and it adds a little more gravity to that end scene. Jean Reno here on screen as Ramon. It's one of the casting choices that I just don't know how I feel about it. I think he's so awkward in a way that I don't know if he's obviously a wonderful actor, Jean Reno, but he's awkward here in a way that I don't know if it's the character or if it's Jean Reno being uncomfortable with his role in this movie, and you know, and doing a Spanish speaking accent, and you know, who knows? We get to note here in this dinner scene that Lisa, despite being a teenager, is allowed to drink wine with her mother and their sort of bohemian friends. Or I like that these theater people that Lisa is exposed to can do voices. You know, maybe they've done voice work. The guy does the great Bobcat Goldthwait. And here, J. Smith Cameron, who, by the way, if you're unaware, J. Smith Cameron, the actress who plays Lisa's mother, who plays Joan, she is in real life. In real life, she is Kenneth Lonergan's wife, Kenneth Lonergan's spouse. So when she auditioned for this part, maybe she might have had a little bit better, easier time than most people, or maybe not, who knows, but but no, I think she's absolutely wonderful as an actress, and wonderful in this part, and her Shirley Temple is dynamite, and so is that baby voice. The editing is real sort of cutty during that dinner scene, and it's I don't know if we need all that cutting. But in a movie this long, sometimes what one approach that some editors might try to make and some filmmakers might try to make in a good long movie is sort of syncopating the rhythm of scenes so that, like what's on screen right now, this slow-mo scene of Lisa walking and sort of being in a daze after that traumatic event that she was a part of with Monica Patterson dying. And I like how these homeboys kind of won't move out of her. I mean, this is very high school thing here. I always felt that, you know, a friend of mine said that, oh yeah, those strange boys that accost Lisa in the street and won't move out of the way or something. I say, first of all, you know, it's not clear to me that they won't move out of the way. She kind of walks as if they're not there. I think that's part of the point, is that she's kind of in a daze. And second of all, how do you know they're strangers? They have backpacks. They look like they could be class. I mean, they probably know Lisa. It's not like there's no diversity in her school. That's the point of some of those scenes, is that there are kids from Arab families and Jewish families and black families with black teachers in the school. And there's Matthew Broderick. I'll finish sort of my overview before we get into the movie too deep. But Matthew Broderick helped finance the movie, especially when Lonergan was having troubles sort of wrangling. And he's friends with Lonergan. And by the way, he's sort of played a high school teacher in that movie, Election, that great movie with Reese Witherspoon. And both he and Damon, I think, look like high school teachers in a way that's just great. And they just sort of fit that bill. Now, this scene here with Darren's back to the camera, and he's having this we're into extended cut territory with this scene. This is not in the theatrical cut. We don't actually see very much interaction between Lisa and Darren in the theatrical cut, and there's a lot more of it, like this scene here. And we overhear the problems of other people, right? We overhear the conversations of other people, right? We're reminded that this drama that's being lived out with our characters that we're following is in the middle of this melting pot that is New York City, where everybody has sort of is living out the opera of their life. And I'll get to that in terms of the thematics later. Anyway, Lonergan approved the shorter theatrical cut, but he did it kind of stamping his feet. He had obviously has great respect for Scorsese and Schoonmaker, and they only did it, you know, because there was not animosity there. They did it with Lonergan's encouragement. But all that wrangling, all that fighting, all that legal wrangling about the length of the movie, the content, it delayed the movie's release for what is these days an incredible amount of time. See, this is what I mean by Anna Paquin, by the way. She's very good here. She cries on screen better than most. And when we cut into Darren here, we see Peter Gallagher Jr., who doesn't really resemble his old man. Lisa is a melodramatic and self-involved teenager, sure, but that doesn't mean her feelings and what she's experiencing are somehow that they should be taken less seriously. Now that scene, I'm not going to point out every single scene that's in the extended cut, you know, the add-ons of the extended cut, or rather the ones that were taken away for the theatrical cut. I won't point out every single instance of it, but that was a good long sequence there in the, and I think an important one in terms of the story. But, I mean, if you look at the amount of years this was delayed after it was in the can, after principal photography had ended and they were in post, from that point in, I think around 2003, to the point I finally saw it in a theater in 2011, 2012, that's a lot of years. And you can see it in the faces of these actors who are much older than they were then, especially Matt Damon and Anna Paquin. And just how, I mean, that happens in Hollywood, but it's important to kind of remember just how rare a thing that is. And for, I think what really made it so protracted was that Lonergan really didn't give in. And wasn't prepared to give in even after 5 years had passed. I mean, we have this stereotype of the bratty kind of self-important artist who's the artiste, and you know, nobody touches my movie and our songs are like our kids, man. But I don't think Lonergan fits that bill, and I don't think that is a fair way to characterize what went on between him and the some of the people who were involved in the funding and production of the movie. But if you're listening to this, I'm sure you know the broad strokes, or you've read about the broad strokes of that background. But I wanted to sort of get that out of the way here, because that's not really most of what I want to talk about with Margaret. The story behind it is fascinating, of course. All that shit with the Scorsese and Schoonmaker being brought in, all that stuff with Matthew Broderick putting up the money, putting up some of the money when Lonergan was having a rough time. Even stuff with casting certain actors, and even if you look at the list of people who are producers and executive producers on this project, Anthony Minghella, Sidney Pollack, once again Scott Rudin. So that sort of behind the scenes stuff is really fascinating with this movie, but it's not as fascinating as the movie itself. I was so grateful when I saw this movie. Actually, when I saw the theatrical cut in the theater, I was sort of perplexed by the movie more than anything, but intrigued deeply. And when I finally, probably a year later, got to see this, and I think this is extended cut territory too, this panning across these windows in the apartment building until we get to Lisa and her mother having a conversation. Once again, the same thing as in the restaurant, this idea that your life might seem like this, it's this dramatic opera, but it's being lived out on literally in New York City, you know, an apartment building like that, on top of the lives of and dramas of all of these other people. And each person, to them, their life seems like a drama. Lisa quotes, I think it's Bernard Shaw, where George Bernard Shaw to her father, saying that she doesn't want to act like the world is somehow her moral gymnasium. But that's something this movie is pondering, I think. But yeah, when I saw the theatrical cut, I was perplexed. But when I finally saw Lonergan's cut, when that was released on DVD, I really got the movie. I got what he's trying to do. There's Olivia Thirlby, by the way, on the left, that quick shot of her. She plays Monica, who is not obviously not the Janie character, but the girl, there she is again, in the pink top and the jean jacket, the girl sitting next to Anna Paquin. She, of course, would become a well-known actress herself. A lot of good New York actors in this movie who have very, very small parts. And apparently a lot of drama actors in the movie, too. I couldn't find the name of that desk sergeant or that detective who gives Lisa a hard time when she goes to the police station. I couldn't be sure of his name on IMDb because the character's name was unclear to me. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. The cop who calls her honey when she actually came there to see Detective Mitchell. I think that actor's fantastic. I think I've seen him on like a Law and Order type show. And in fact, one of the people credited in the credits has a lot of those kinds of credits, but I couldn't be sure if it was that actor. This sort of paradigm in Lisa's classroom is so typical, too, of the way high school is taught these days. You have one sort of older instructor and then this younger sort of instructor, and they kind of tandem teach, and they sort of allow the kids to argue in this way without... And they sort of stoke the argument with imbalanced information, you know? I think conservatives who say that teachers and academia and the way history and stuff is taught is you know, with a liberal slant, and maybe that's not a good thing. I think they have a point, but of course their solution is to just have more conservative content taught, or teach the controversy or shit like that. And of course, I think these kinds of things should be handled neutrally and without a political slant. You can't erase all political motivations from the way content is presented, but how asinine that kind of thing can get is sort of illustrated in these scenes with the kids arguing. And it's another good example of the kids sort of, you know, the teachers are just as, being just as juvenile as the kids in that sort of scene. Here in the sound mix, one of the reasons I decided this would be a good movie to try having the sound on a little bit in the background is because of the sound mix that is one of the things that was changed when Lonergan finally got to release, when they shortened Lonergan's cut that he turned in, Lonergan's extended cut, they redid a lot of the sound and the music, and there's a lot of overheard conversations, like when Lisa and her mom were walking down the street there. You could hear the conversations of other people. And I think it's Lonergan, for one thing it's doing, is really trying to capture what it's like to be in New York. I mean, in a crowded subway car, you don't have any choice but to eavesdrop on the conversations of other people, whether they're on the phone or talking to someone else. If you're in a crowded cafe or a restaurant, you've got to put up with it. You can't help but overhear, and it becomes white noise. These people could be talking about very grave things and things that are matters of life and death and very important matters, like Lisa was talking about with Darren, or like she's talking about in the cab with her mom. But it just becomes white noise when you live in a big city like New York, and I think that's nicely captured by the movie and by Lonergan's original approach to the sound mix. Here's our first shot of the director himself, the man himself, Kenneth Lonergan. He plays Lisa's father, Carl, who is, the movie doesn't tell us until later and only in a couple of lines of dialogue, but he's obviously there divorced. He lives out in, you know, California, sort of, well-to-do, but, you know, not what you'd call wealthy. he shoots commercials, we hear, and he has this sort of new wife who's presented as kind of mean or just testy, or maybe just the scenes we see her, she's in a bad mood. But they really emphasize the difference in lifestyle between father and daughter here. He's not just separated by distance, he's separated by a kind of the breeziness, with the way, and Lonergan's choice to play this part himself, I think, is interesting too. Look at the way, the breeziness of the way he walks across this deck in his sandals, the way those gulls are walking around in the background, the shore, the water, compared to this bedroom in this apartment where Lisa is, with the candles. It seems to be nighttime or close to nighttime in New York, but it's bright and sunny out in California. They're not just separated by distance, they're separated by, you know, what the world around them looks like. And one of the big themes for me in the movie is people miscommunicate, people who are living different kinds of lives, being unable to communicate, to understand each other, or to even really communicate effectively. And in every relationship in the movie, I think that's true on some level, and perhaps no more so than here. I think that the two characters who are the most different to me in the movie, or who are the most, who have the hardest time communicating, I should say, is actually Lisa and her dad. If you really listen to the way the dialogue goes, and you really listen to the way they talk to each other, and the way she kind of knows just what to say to him to placate him, and he knows just what to say so that he sounds like a good dad, but it's not that they're not listening to each other, it's that they're handling each other, you know, and not really talking. I know that sounds touchy-feely, but I really do think that's what Lonergan, who of course is a great playwright, I really think that's what he's after. I love that Joan tells Ramon that he's smooth. She thinks that he's some sort of, you know, he thinks he's some kind of game player, and everything we see from Ramon indicates that he's just an earnest person. And she has trouble even understanding him because he really is like an earnest person. Not like an earnest person, he is an earnest person. Now, Becky here is played by an actress named Sarah Steele. And in the theatrical cut, I'm not going to go on and on about, once again, about differences between theatrical cut and Lonergan cut, but whole relationship between Becky and why there's tension in their friendship and what Becky's talking about there makes much more sense, and we understand Lisa a lot more in Lonergan's cut, and that was kind of sold short in the theatrical cut. Again, Lonergan considers both his vision. He doesn't object to the theatrical cut. It's just not what he turned in, and it's easy to imagine how he feels. There's Kieran Culkin, who, of course, would go on to be very funny in movies like Scott Pilgrim. And I think these two actors at the time, they still would be roughly the same age. And the way everybody is, you know, the different types or different kinds of kids that you have in a high school. The cool kid who has drugs, the sort of smart kid who's earnest, like Darren here, who's earnest and but a little bit unsure of himself. You know, Lonergan gives us, or the pretty girl, Lisa, you know, Lonergan gives us these types that we recognize from real life, but they're not... you know, they're not caricatures. Everybody gets to be a real character in this movie. Everybody gets to have a story. The whole thing between Lisa and Darren as she kisses him here, in the theatrical version, when he has that scene on his bed where he cries, it's almost like we're not sure what's... We just know that he's upset because she's sort of giving him the cold shoulder, but why he's crying, and it makes much more sense in Lonergan's cut, because we see more of this kind of thing, what you're seeing on screen right now with Lisa, as she said a moment ago, I guess I'm not very consistent. Well, in Lonergan's cut, we see that she jerks, she does kind of jerk him around a lot. She does kind of I don't want to say toy with his emotions, but I mean, she's just a kid too, you know, but she does kind of send mixed signals, and that kind of mixed signals and not knowing how to handle a relationship and wanting to push someone away while appreciating that they're interested in you. That, I mean, that's all kind of age appropriate stuff. There's J. Smith Cameron's boobs. It's probably easier to do a nude scene when you're, I would think, when your husband is directing you than if, you know, someone else is. Now, a lot of people don't notice, but this gym teacher here who's teaching the kids yoga, and she's so enthusiastic and so nice to them, and like we can see down her boobs there. And then the kids aren't even responsive to her. You see them just standing there. They don't want to do it. Like, I don't know. It's the movie is filled with these little moments like that are just really realistic. Apparently Will Hunting in this movie has grown up and become a teacher in New York City. Mr. Aaron is also one of those characters in the movie that is very earnest, but all the main characters in the movie sort of make mistakes and have errors in judgment. And this bit of business of the kids waiting out in the hall is, I cited this to one of my friends as an example of really great screenwriting, just an everyday example of what I think is really great screenwriting. It sort of gives them a ticking clock to this conversation and overlays a whole other kind of tension. And also it's exactly right. I mean, it would be unrealistic if they were having a conversation after class, and it went on for 20 minutes. I mean, he has to teach another class, so of course they'd be waiting out in the hall. And it's just those paying attention to the reality of a scene that I really like. And the way Mr. Aaron sort of yells at that kid. I have a couple friends who are high school teachers, and the idea that a male teacher would go, quote-unquote, out for coffee after school with a female student, or really any teacher going out with any student, is kind of not something that, I don't want to say not something they're supposed to do, but not something a prudent teacher would do or should do, just because of appearances. Now I know that sometimes they go out with a group of students, that's different, but just one student, is probably something that, like I said, the better part of prudence wouldn't be to do that. This is really great dialogue here, right? The way that this miscommunication happens, the way that this conversation misfires, the way that Lisa responds to her mother here. See, Anna Paquin's very good here. A lot of actresses would play this differently, I feel. She just says, hey, well, you like the magic flute? And it's like, okay, well, I guess I was wrong. You know, I mean, that's a very teenager response. But they're both kind of acting immature with this conversation. They both are. It's nobody's fault. That's the other thing in this movie. You see how Joan gets angry with her daughter here. And the way she makes her point is by being an actress, which is very funny and very ironic. It's not quite irony, I guess, but the way she makes her point to her daughter is by giving her daughter a taste of her own medicine, using this gift she has for mimicry and for acting as a sword to kind of make a point. The fact that she calls her a cunt is obviously deplorable, but it really raises the stakes of the conversation, because you notice Joan instantly apologizes for it, or basically says that she shouldn't have done it, and she, after the cunt remark, and then Lisa calls her a big cunt, neither one of them mean it. They just, sometimes you have a conversation and you get so mad that you mean it in that moment, but you don't really mean it. But I like Lisa just sort of sarcastically says, and you're a big cunt. I don't like that word, but it's... the way Lisa yells at her here is sort of accusing her mom of kind of egotism. They both accuse each other of egotism, and they're both right. They're both right, and they're both wrong in this conversation. That doesn't make sense, but neither does this conversation. There you go. There's a whole city out there full of people who are dying. It's so trivial. Why are you bothering me with all this? It doesn't matter. That's, I just read the subtitles there. What Lisa was saying. Lisa doesn't really... teenagers will have that perspective sometimes, will express that perspective, but it's not clear that Lisa really thinks that her mom should care about all the people suffering out there. I mean, it's just not practical for any one person to care about the suffering of everyone else in the world at all times. But thinking about that and thinking about that in that way and seeing, you know, your sort of charmed life as trivial in relationship to that is a thought that we all have as teenagers, when we're teenagers. But it's at once a mature thought and an immature thought is what I mean. And here's our first experience with the opera in the movie. Once again, the conversation we'll get after this. Whoops, sorry about that. The conversation that we'll get after this between Joan and Ramon, will once again be a great example of them getting along while at the same time miscommunicating. Joan is actually trying to relate to him while at the same time trying to express that she was not totally at home or comfortable at the opera, but she still explains it in a way, I should wait till the scene starts, but explains it in a way where she wants Ramon to kind of explain it to her in a way. She wants to have a conversation about it, and Ramon just kind of explains it away, and it actually becomes a miscommunication where he doesn't really totally understand her. A friend of mine said, well, that's a language barrier, and I thought, you know, people sometimes think that when people speak English with an accent, I'm not accusing my friend of this, but I think sometimes generally when someone speaks English with an accent, English speakers, particularly Americans, sometimes assume that speaking English with an accent is the same as broken English or imperfect English or not understanding English well. I speak French. I'm capable of being more or less conversant in French. And I speak French with kind of an American accent. I can't help it, but I understand French when someone speaks French to me. I basically understand all the words and I can respond in kind, but you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mean I don't understand French because I speak it with a slight, you know, New York accent. And you see the blasé way and the way they both, in this little conversation where she offers her virginity to a guy that she knows will not bother her with his emotional attachment to her. Again, kind of an age-appropriate impulse, I guess. Now, this shot here that you have of Peter Gallagher Jr., Darren calling her, and Lisa says she doesn't want to get together when she's actually going to be sleeping with Paul tonight. Well, she doesn't tell him that, but I'm just saying that's what's going on. And she says she's writing a paper about King Lear, just after she put on her, what is that, a halter top? What kind of top do they call that? But when he weeps here, after he hangs up the phone, when he cries, you don't, in the theatrical cut, you don't understand it as much as in this cut, because we had that restaurant scene between he and Lisa in which he expressed feelings for her and thought that they should pursue those feelings, and she shut him down. And he's still trying here, and so, but then she kissed him at the party and said what she said, and so you can understand why he's confused and a little down on himself. It just seems out of nowhere in the theatrical cut, is what I'm saying. And by the way, I'm sure Schoonmaker and Scorsese recognize that, but you have to make sacrifices when you have to make a movie at least this long, or at least this short, no matter what. The sort of very adult way that they talk to each other, these teenagers, it's this kind of intensely or purposely adult way, using big words and abstract ideas and sort of being meta, being matter of fact about things that when you're in your teens are actually kind of a big deal, like having read a book of that length, and being able to know it, you know. I like that we're not allowed, especially in the extended cut, we're not really allowed to hate Paul. In fact, when they have that scene with the drama teacher, where he makes everybody, another scene where a teacher is doing something that's supposed to be good for the kids, but it's actually destructive, in which he makes the kids sort of say what they hate about each other, basically, or what they resent about each other. And in that scene especially, we're allowed to like Paul because he sort of is the voice of reason in a way. That's really reckless what he did, opening the beers like that. But right there, is a good example too. What Lisa said there, that line of dialogue, is there's a name for this, that a screenwriting term, or sort of a term I've heard people use for when a character says something that the audience was probably thinking, but I've forgotten what the term is. It might not exist, but she said what I was thinking the first time I saw the movie at this point. Why does everything Paul says sound ironic? You're not even trying to sound that way. It's just his persona. It's when you're a teenager, you don't have a personality so much as you're trying on personalities. I saw a psychiatrist explain that once, much more elegantly. And right now he's trying on the aloof kind of cool guy, and he does it very well, so much so that pretty young girls offer their virginity to him. Oh, by the way, the reason I refer to it as the Lonergan cut, let me just get some coffee here. The reason I refer to it as the Lonergan cut and the theatrical cut is because Lonergan made I think it was an interview where he made the statement about he didn't think of this as a director's cut, like, you know, Ridley Scott's Alien director's cut or any kind of director's cut, Apocalypse Now, Redux, you know. He didn't regard this as a director's cut. He regarded this as his vision, and the theatrical cut was also his vision. It just wasn't what he turned in. So he has a way of parsing the language. But given that I'm, as I've already said, I'm sort of on his side in that, in terms of, I don't think he's a bratty, egotistical artiste. You know, I don't think he's a wannabe. I think he's a real guy with real integrity, and I'll accept and use his preferred terminology. We get this whole sex scene here in dark silhouette, but I like how the lighting and the nature of the way this is silhouetted allows us to still sort of make out the distinguishing features of both actors so that we know that that's Lisa sort of underneath there and that that's Paul on top, because they both have long hair, but it's silhouetted in a way that there's very sharp lines. Probably a very awkward sex scene to shoot. The cinematographer on this movie that worked with Lonergan on this movie was a Polish cinematographer named Ryszard Leniejowski. And if there's anyone who speaks Polish listening to this, I butchered that Polish name. It's actually probably a very beautiful sounding name if someone who knows how to pronounce it pronounces it. But he's sort of a cinematographer who's Polish and done a lot of Polish TV, and not really someone that I had been very familiar with. But I like a lot of the cinematography choices in this movie. It's interesting that in a movie that where so much of the photography is absorbing the surroundings of New York, and in this extended cut, of course, we have that long scene on Ramon's balcony where we get to, the camera just allows us to sit back and take in this wonderful panorama of New York City at around dusk. So much of this movie is about the sights and sounds and textures of New York City. And yet, he went and got someone who I don't think is from New York, or someone who's even, from what I can detect on IMDb, a cinematographer who's even photographed New York very much for movies or television. I just think that's one of the really cool choices about the movie that I wonder what other people who like the movie think about that. I don't say that enough, by the way. Many people write in, when I say something that they disagree with in a commentary, or when I wonder about something and they sort of have a point of view on it. I really, really like that, and I always respond. Please email in if I'm wrong about something, or I'm right about something, or you think that you can explain something to me that I'm perplexed at. I just love that stuff. I love corresponding with people about movies in that way. And the email address is right at the top of robcaravaggio.blogspot.com, and the email address is right there at the top of the page. Really appreciate those folks who email in. This movie was actually requested by Sam, who's someone who emails in. Now, I think this post-coital scene here is not in the theatrical cut, and it's clear that the way the theatrical cut, or the way the cut that we're watching here was pared down, was one of the approaches they took was one of the decisions they made was, all right, look, we're just going to make this whole pregnancy thing and the paternity and we're just going to make that ambiguous, and we're going to take out the whole abortion thing so that it just becomes this rabbit Lisa pulls out of a hat at that point in the movie. And that has a pretty cool effect, I must say. I didn't hate it the first time I saw it, but we don't have this scene in the theatrical cut where she's in the robe and she talks about she doesn't want to get AIDS, and he says, why? Because we didn't use birth control. So I didn't have a point there. I'm just saying that seems to be a real approach they took is, okay, they just decided to save time, we're just going to make that whole thing ambiguous because maybe it's better that way, or maybe it's ambiguous to the characters in a way too that resonates with the action of the movie. But I like the extended version so much more, and I think the extended version actually feels shorter because and stay with me here because the scenes have a have a thrust to them that so many of them were gutted for the theatrical cut. And the scenes sort of play out more naturally, and there aren't these leaps that you have in the theatrical cut. I don't think the theatrical cut is worthless, though. In fact, I think the best way to engage Margaret as a work of art is to first, for people who haven't seen it, is to first view the theatrical cut and then view the extended cut. I think that's absolutely the best way to do it. It happens to be the way I was exposed to it and the way most people were, I guess, because Lonergan's cut didn't come out on DVD. It didn't come out until the movie was put out on DVD. But I really think that's the best way to do it. In the background here, we hear sort of opera-style music. And oh, she's wearing those slippers that are like boots. Look at that. Now, people, women, I was going to say that's a very 2003 thing, but women still wear those, right? They would have been cutting edge, though, at that time. Yeah. The music was changed drastically in the sound mixing for the theatrical cut. Lonergan had done some more adventurous things with it, especially with the overheard conversations. And he was using overheard conversations in a way that's different from, say, the way Robert Altman would use them. It's very much a thing that gets you from here to there, or that that pulls you into a scene, rather than a thing that feels chaotic or gives a scene kinetic energy. Now, here's what I was talking about before. Joan is trying to relate to Ramon here. And she's saying, and she's trying to kind of be herself and be a humorous, pleasant person. And she's saying, oh, I enjoyed it, but why, don't you think people who do that are pretentious when they say bravi instead of bravo? Why don't they just say, and Ramon says he wants to simply show that he's sophisticated and understands it, but he keeps explaining it to her like, no, it's the plural. And then if it's just a woman, you say bravi. And she goes, no, I get that, but don't you think it's pretentious when people do? I know it's correct, but don't you think it's pretentious? And he goes, pretentious? No, what? What are you talking about? and it's just like, it's a complete miscommunication. They can't even sort of relate to each other on the same level. He comes from a different world, Ramon. It's very interesting that he's likes her so much. She seems puzzled that he likes her so much, given that she'll say to him later, don't you think we have a problem misunderstanding each other? He says something like, well, why should we think, we shouldn't even think about that. Why would you even trouble ourselves to think about that? You know, he's kind of old school. It's not as, you know, you have to analyze everything. Can't we just be in a relationship. And it's very kind of old school, but very kind of practical too, in a way. And it's not as narcissistic as the world Joan comes from, if that makes any sense. It's not as analytical. I really like the inclusion of that through that character. Now, this is extended cut. This is a romp through the extended cut. This was completely excised in the theatrical version. This cathartic hug that Lisa has, we get to see Paul's girlfriend that he, on whom he cheated with Lisa. This whole, you know, thing that the drama teacher is making them do of confronting each other with their resentments, in an effort to heal those resentments, is, I won't listen to any argument that someone would make that this is somehow healthy for a teacher who is a drama teacher and not likely to be a a clinician or a therapist to stage this kind of thing, literally, having them do it on a stage, you know. And you notice the way the camera moves and the sort of low angle, they literally are on a stage, the lighting. It's this opera. He makes them state their feelings in an operatic way and have these cathartic hugs. And I do think it's destructive. but enough criticizing of this fictional teacher. But I can see why they... Now, this is something that was cut that I can see why they cut it. I mean, it really helps us understand Lisa because she has that moment with Darren. It really helps us understand where she comes from, like where she goes to school, what it's like to be in this school where the kids are almost... Can I say this? I mean, the kids are almost built up too much. They're told that they're told they're important in a way that I don't know is always healthy. I know that sounds curmudgeonly, but Jesus, you know. I mean, and the way the drama teacher was speaking to them, I mean, it's just it makes you want to hug Paul for what he says here. Now he frames this as, you know, I don't feel like what he just said there. I don't feel a deep need to, you know, be this dramatic like you guys are being dramatic. You see how delighted his girlfriend is with his charms. But, and the teacher responds with sort of sarcasm. But you see the way the character Paul becomes in this scene becomes a real character too, because he frames that as, you know, I don't feel this deep need that other people seem to feel for all this drama, you know. And but really, he's the voice of reason there. He's saying like, hey, can't these kids here just be kids? You know, if you don't give it that first person thing where he's talking about himself and smoking pot on the roof, and if you just sort of frame it as, these are just kids, let them be kids, you know. They shouldn't, if they resent each other that much for working on this play, maybe there's too much pressure on them for something that's trivial, ultimately. I don't know. I could get on a whole kick about how education treats kids differently from when I was in high school, but you know, I certainly wasn't built up in high school. Let's put it that way, and I don't think that's necessarily bad. You know, I was told to shut up, do my work, and keep my nose clean, and wait till I'm an adult to have adult experiences. And I don't know that that was a bad thing. I didn't listen, but the messaging had its effect, I think. The actor playing Detective Mitchell is Stephen Adley Gurgis, or Gurgis. Stephen Adley Gurgis. And that looks like a Greek name, the last name Gurgis. G-U-I-R-G-I-S, perhaps Greek. But he's very good. He gets the whole flavor of a cop, a New York City cop. This is our first introduction, of course, to the family of Monica Patterson. These cousins who don't give a shit and are kind of don't care. And we learn later that Monica Patterson didn't have a very warm relationship with them, actually. They are simply the people who are related to her, but Monica probably didn't like them, and she actually had a whole battle with them about an inheritance, and she didn't appreciate them. And we learn that gradually. We learn it through the Emily character. But I like that they're sort of so stern, and they sort of, once again... I'll flog my big theme of the movie, miscommunication. Once again, in this scene, there is a miscommunication going on, right? They just don't get why Lisa's calling. Who are you? What do you want? Are you harassing me? Yes, you're harassing me. And Lisa's being, you know, actually during the conversation, she gets progressively more sort of childlike. She starts off very adult and I'm not trying to harass you. And the see the sound mix here in the extended cut, you can really hear longer, her brother playing for Elise in the background, practicing his piano. And it's very this scene is actually kind of important, you know, the way that Lisa finds out that Emily even exists and that Emily is the executor of Monica Patterson's estate is because it's the one thing these assholes who were related to Monica Patterson, the one useful thing they do for Lisa is they give her Emily's number. And so it's kind of by chance that she even knows that Emily exists. This whole fascination with the woman that she saw dying, who died, and the whole effort to reconstruct knowing this woman through Jeannie Berlin character here is, once again, I think a very realistic teenager thing. You know, she wants to. She wants to have this experience, but she's. It's cathartic for her at the same time, and the confusion of all this, I think, is something Paquin's performance really nails. Okay, so now we've got Emily on the screen. I can get into this character, Emily, and I can just take sip of coffee here and do that. Sorry. We're all here because we love Monica, she just said. Jeannie Berlin, of course, the daughter of Elaine May, who is the funniest thing in that Woody Allen movie, Small Time Crooks, by the way, which I contend is a great movie. But this is Elaine May's daughter, Jeannie Berlin, playing Emily. I think it is a absolute brilliant casting choice, and I can say without hyperbole that I think the Emily character is, without question, one of the most compelling and multifaceted and fascinating, fucking fascinating movie characters I have ever seen in a movie. I am fascinated with this character. You see Lonergan just holds the camera on her here. The way she sort of owns this part, the way she, you can see that she is you can see why Lisa is drawn to her. Well, it's a lot of reasons why anybody would be. She's a dynamic person, Emily, and you can see she's a person who feels and who can express herself clearly. And she appears to be educated. She appears to be she appears to have real emotions, and she doesn't do melodrama, Emily. Everything she experiences is real. Nothing's an act. So in many ways, she would remind Lisa of Joan, of Lisa. She would remind Lisa of her mother, because both Emily and Joan are educated, well-spoken, professional women. But Emily seems to spend most of her time, at least in the context of the movie, and from Lisa's point of view, seems to spend most of her time involved in finding justice for this friend of hers who died. By the way, this is a great shot one of the great New York shots that Lonergan gives us, just looking up the street there at all the cars and the ground slicked with rain. The camera now tracking this or shooting or photographing what looks like it might be early morning. This plane flying overhead, which is an image. Remember, this movie was slated to be released originally. It was scheduled for release in 2007. Originally, it was supposed to be released before that. And after 9/11, as a post 9/11 movie, this plane just flying over Manhattan is a. Yeah, you know, I remember that day. You know, this is a very poignant thing. As we hear Lisa trying to find information about this bus driver, we get these images of the city. It's just these cool little choices that you can analyze them to pieces. Anyway, the Emily character, the Jeannie Berlin character, I'll get back to her when she's back on screen, but if I were to list the most fascinating, memorable movie characters I ever saw in a movie, I'm positive she would be on my list, the Emily character. And just talk about getting the right actress who sort of seems to understand the cultural context in which the character exists, but also seems to understand that the seething, righteous anger that this character has is itself a product of, you know, the fact that she hurts, the fact that she's her friend is gone, and that she also has these other things in her life that she hurts over. And her, you know, she is real in a way that Lisa's mother is not real, is kind of an actress. More on her later, on Jeannie Berlin's character, I mean. But this advice that Lonergan, playing Lisa's dad, this advice that Lonergan just gives Lisa is kind of dumb. You know, you just ignore the guy and he's going to be doing backflips. I mean, it seems like dated advice, but it's exactly the kind of thing a well-meaning dad would give to his daughter. I like that we don't get the whole conversation in which Lisa explain. I mean, this is sort of movie making 101 too. I mean, we don't need to hear Lisa explain the whole situation to her dad about this accident she witnessed, and the situation she's in with the police now, because we know it, and so we can just cut around it and pick up the conversation, the part where he goes, "Oh, well, that's a crazy situation." This is also very smart screenwriting. The fact that his wife walks in and starts pestering him, you know, husbands pester wives too. It's not just wives who pester, but it's a marriage moment, you might say. I mean, it's just he's on the phone, he's talking to his daughter about something serious, and she's talking about lunch, and she finally gets to him so much that he says he wants to blow his brains out, which is wonderful. It's coming up here in a sec. Like, she wants to ask what Lisa wants to eat when she comes by, but he's talking about what was literally a life and death situation, and a situation where Lisa has to make a choice. This is a very operatic movie in the way it's written too. I'm going to blow my brains out, he just said. In the way it's written, because Lisa has a true dilemma. That word dilemma gets misused by people. It's like the word literally. A dilemma, a di, that prefix means two. So a dilemma is when someone has a choice between two options. I should do A or I should do B. Which do I choose? It's not just being in a tough situation. It's having two distinct choices. Lisa has to choose to go to the police with her information, the information she knows, or she has to choose to stay silent. And I love that the Shaw quote, the movie explores that Shaw quote about, you know, the world being your moral gymnasium. It explores that quote as, you know, this quote that she's regurgitating as if she thought of it. And the father recognizes it, you know. It's just, I love those little moments. So as soon as we see the blood, we know we're in dreamland, right? But when we see Alice and Janney again, that was truly frightening when I was in the theater. Now, the two dreams there, the first dream that Lisa had was, of course, just her mother sitting on her bed looking at her with a blank stare. And the second dream involved Lisa trying to wash herself clean in the sink in her hands and instead getting blood on her hands. So it's not hard to catch the suggestiveness or the symbolism of that second dream. The first dream is the one that I think we almost don't need, you know. You could even have the second dream be her mother and Alice and Janney standing behind her. It was so creepy in the theater, too. People were freaked the fuck out when they saw Alice and Janney. Because if you rewind it, you'll see Alice and Janney actually had blood on her and was wearing the same outfit she wore when that character died from the bus accident. So very creepy, very creepy when I saw it. That's an old car there on the left that's on screen now. I didn't get a good enough look at it, but it's from the 1930s, it looked like. It's all shiny. They must be in Manhattan, but Lisa is supposed to be in Brooklyn here. This sort of bungalow that Moretti lives in, the bus driver played by Ruffalo. I guess Lonergan likes Ruffalo as an actor. He used him in You Can Count on Me. He's sort of like a Jeff Goldblum type to me, Ruffalo. I feel like there's always Ruffalo. All his characters are basically Mark Ruffalo, but just with slight alterations. Like Mark Ruffalo never quite disappears. I think he can be used really well in like movies like Zodiac, but most of the time I feel like, I don't know, he's sort of neither old nor young. He's one of those actors that's just probably hard for him to find parts that he really wants to do, but I do think he's very good here. The awkwardness of this encounter here. And of course, playing his wife here, Mrs. Moretti, is Rosemary DeWitt. There she is. The wonderful Rosemary DeWitt. I like the idea of this scene. What I mean by that is I like a scene in which someone just shows up and says, I want to talk to you. And they'd had an encounter before. And so the person knows who this person who's showing up knows who it is, but doesn't know what this is about or what's going on. And just that confusion. But I like the idea that his wife is there and saying, who the fuck is this teenage girl? Let her use the bathroom. Who is she? And you can tell that she's suspicious that, you know, is this some affair that you've had? And the shit scene. This is now Schoonmaker and Scorsese felt that the shit scene should be excised because I don't remember it from the theatrical version. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Now I don't have a precise memory, and I didn't look up this question before I started the movie here, but I don't remember it in the theatrical version. Could be wrong, but the fact that, you know, I mean, just seeing someone take a shit in a movie is to underscore their nervousness is really, I think, unique. We don't see that all the time. Except in comedies, you know, like Dumb and Dumber, we see someone shitting. But not in dramas. Sort of realistic. Yeah, you see, like, the Rosemary DeWitt character saying, okay, what is going on here? And her husband's like, why don't you just appease her, go inside, and let me find out what this is. It's just a very realistic awkwardness of when someone shows up and you don't know why and you're scared and obviously, you know, it's beyond awkward. And as a teenager, he infantilizes her even more than she feels infantilized, and she doesn't quite know what to say. She doesn't know what to say here. Now, yeah, see, Paquin doesn't get, I wonder why she doesn't get enough credit. I mean, she's just very good here. I like this performance. I mean, she's very good at just playing that kid who is capable of, you know, just says the wrong thing. Like, that's another pattern in the movie. People are always saying the wrong thing and backtracking and apologizing and misspeaking. Seeing people, you know, these days politicians say, well, I misspoke. You know, some politician says something about legitimate rape, quote unquote, and then comes out and says he misspoke. Well, you didn't misspoke. You just believe something nutty and you said it out loud. That's not misspeaking. That's speaking. You just regret what you said, or you regret that there was a microphone in front of you. To truly misspeak is to do what Lisa did a moment ago when they were in the house. She sort of, or a moment ago in this conversation, where she said she was trying to clarify something. She said, I don't mean romantically. And then Ruffalo goes, romantically? Now what are you talking about? You know, and she was trying to clarify something, and but she said it in a way that, to misspeak is to say something the wrong way, not to, to phrase something the wrong way. It occurs to me now, I haven't even spoken about or given my view on the central moral, ethical quandary or question of the movie that these two characters are arguing about right now, which is, what is the right thing to do in Lisa's situation? Who is responsible for this death? Does it make sense to assign blame or culpability to the driver? Who caused Monica Patterson's death? Was it negligence? Can you call it negligence on the driver? Can you call it negligence on Lisa's part? Is it relevant that he had some, you know, some other, you know, other things on his, work, or employment history with the driving buses that are questionable? Does it matter that this would ruin his life? As he says, he's got a wife and kids in there. This is his livelihood. And, like he's just saying right now, who's going to take care of my family? You? Should he lose his job and be run out of town on a rail and sent to the poorhouse because he was negligent in this way and made a mistake? We haven't even gotten to the legal questions that the movie addresses. And I think the movie really elegantly explains how the law applies in this situation through the Dave character and through the Deutsch character. But, I'm sure people will want to know what I, or might wonder what I think about, you know, what the right thing to do is for Lisa or who's responsible. When you watch the movie, you'll see there's a green light again as the scene ends, right? The green light, of course, when the accident happened, the light was red. It was yellow, it was green, then it was yellow, and then it was red. And the bus continued through the red because the walk sign had come on. And so Monica Patterson, played by Janney, thought it was safe to walk, and she had her cart, a shopping cart, and she walked out, and it was an accident that was caused by the fact that the bus ran the red light. Lisa was distracting the driver while he was driving a bus, and the driver was, in a sense, allowing himself to be distracted. So there's responsibility on both their, this is my view, there's responsibility on both of them there that caused this accident. You can't assign any responsibility to Monica Patterson because she walked when the sign said walk. You could say that maybe she should have looked before she walked, but that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that the negligence is on the part of the driver and on the part of the on the part of Lisa for distracting him, especially with something so trivial as a stupid cowboy hat and where he got it, as if that mattered. Like she comes out in this performance shot out of a cannon because she's angry from her personal life. And we realize it's a comedy. Yeah. What's the name of the play? Controversy, right? So I think clearly responsibility, I don't mean legal responsibility, I'm just, as an ethical question, just to finish up my take on the central question of the movie, the ethical question. It's Lisa's fault, and it's the driver's fault that this happened. It's their, if they don't act reckless in the way they were reckless, Monica Patterson probably still be alive because the bus wouldn't have ran the red light. Now, where it gets into very difficult ethical questions, so that's not the hard ethical question. Where it gets into difficult ethical questions for me is, what then should the law or what should society do to provide restitution to the victim's family, and what is a fair thing for to have happen to the people who acted recklessly and caused this to happen? You know, should the guy lose his job? Should there be a lawsuit? Should something happen to Lisa? I mean, the way it shakes out, no responsibility is put on Lisa. It's all put on the driver. Ultimately, legally, he's the one operating the vehicle. That's why I phrased it that way. He allows himself to be distracted. He didn't have to pay any attention to some girl screaming at him about a hat. In fact, he's duty-bound not to, in a sense. The Gerard Manley Hopkins poem that gives the movie its title is one of the more avant-garde moves that the movie makes. It is Margaret, you mourn for it. There you go. Gerard Manley Hopkins, of course, was there's his lifetime on the blackboard behind the teacher there. He was a Catholic priest who was a fine poet too, in the 19th century. And he wrote poems like that, poems about, religious ecstasy, poems about longing, poems about yearning. And it is an avant-garde move to give the movie that title. It does. This is one of those movies where I'm not sure that the title even matters that much, you know, because you get so deep into the movie that, you know, they could just call this, you know, red light, green light or something stupid like that. The movie could also, would make a good comedy too. Just you take the inciting incident and some of the story beats and you've got a kind of funny comedy. Now, again, I couldn't ascertain the name of this actor. I know I've seen him before, who plays this detective who obviously is a colleague of Mitchell and who gives Lisa all this guff. Now, this is another example of miscommunication in the movie, but he's a real dick to her. He sees that this is obviously a teenager. she doesn't give him really any, she doesn't give him any attitude or trouble off the bat. He gets very cop on her. He says, he, you know, dresses her down about using the wrong terminology. Only the DA closes the case. You don't close the case. I like how he has little dumbbells on his desk there too. What the fuck? Why would he need those at his desk? One of those little squeeze balls, you know. But he gives her shit about, you know, saying things the wrong way or and I like that she stands up for herself there and then looks nervous that she just said that. But she should. She shouldn't let people call her honey. She's nobody's honey. She's a person, and you know my name, call me my name. But this guy plays a really, I just love the scene, but this guy plays a really great cop, you know, because he gets very cop on her. All right, first of all, you're going to calm down. Well, I am calm. You know, cops are always telling people to calm down, and they are calm. I believe police officers are trained to be calm and sort of serene, to not be people who fly off the handle and stuff, but... That little scene actually isn't integral to the story, right? That little scene where she gets into that tiff with Detective Mitchell's colleague there. What does that matter? You could just skip over that, but it matters because we have to see that Lisa is going. For one thing, we have to see that Lisa is going to some lengths to try and do what she thinks might be the right thing and clarify her involvement with this case, and help, and then of course help Emily find, sue the bus company. Now I like the way the movie handles the law and, explains the legal ramifications of all this. The actor, once again, the actor, Stephen Adley Gerges, actually explains, the aggravating factor thing very clearly to Lisa and, of course, to the audience. It's why this is, I think, partially why this is staged in this way, is because he's kind of explaining this to the audience, and the Dave character will do that too. And this was a big laugh line when I saw this theatrically, when he says, what does he have to do, kill her on purpose? And he says, yes, because that's what murder is, killing someone on purpose. And she tells the truth. She says, no, that isn't what happened. That isn't what he did. But when you kill someone accidentally because of recklessness, that's something else. And it's true that, you know, trying to pursue something like this the way she is, the way this character is, as a criminal matter, as he's just telling her now, is probably not going to get you very far, because... unless, as he says, with the aggravating factors, unless he was high, or drunk, or, you know, there has to be another aggravating factor. The way to pursue it, if you want some sort of, quote unquote justice, is through the civil courts, which is where the movie goes. But, I like that these legal things are really explained in depth, but quickly and clearly by the movie, and always in the context of one character explaining it to another character, and both characters are integral to the story, and especially the character who's having it explained to them is someone who needs to understand that in the context of the story, so it doesn't seem like an information dump for the audience's sake, which is what it is ultimately, but there are very elegant ways to do that. Now, this is a very New York kind of scene here with Mr. Aaron and the bike. Now, I think this is chopped up too in the theatrical cut. I believe that this encounter is sort of truncated, and, you know, the testing of the bike doesn't happen, but I don't recall precisely. Let me just get a sip of coffee here. Sorry about that. Long movie. But once again, does it feel long? It doesn't to me. it feels brisk. And it just really, really pulls you into everything that's going on. Especially the extended cut. The extended cut feels especially brisk. I felt the length of the movie in the theatrical cut, but not in this cut. A testament to Lonergan's vision, I think. And you see how she's fascinated with adults who are sort of slightly older than her, and all very realistic, and the way she tries to come off as more sophisticated with this teacher that she's crushing on by saying, you know, well, you're from Indiana, what made you want to come teach rich, white, liberal Jews? You know, he seems to be an earnest, nice guy. That's probably not what he was thinking. He probably doesn't, you know, view it that way. He just wanted to be a teacher. But she, sort of, that's her attempt at seduction, is sort of trying to communicate with him on his level as an adult. But what she doesn't know, what she can't know, is that what he's experiencing is quite juvenile too. He knows that he's in weird territory with this student. He knows that, and Matt Damon's very good in this performance too. I mean, he knows that he's in weird territory with this student. He knows that it's getting a little personal. And now when she says what she just said there, it's crossed the line. And he knows that, I would say if you're a teacher, you've allowed it to cross this line by, you know, getting a little too familiar, allowing the student to get a little too familiar. But that can happen without people doing anything wrong, too. It's just, you know, she's obviously very intent on screwing him. But, you know, a psychologist, a clinical psychologist or psychiatrist could really do a number on this movie in terms of analyzing the characters and why they're behaving the way they're behaving. You know, what's going on with Lisa that makes her want to do that? Makes her want to seduce her teacher. Makes her want to complicate her life even while this is going on. All this drama is going on around her and with her. And you see, they just had this sort of confrontation, and now J. Smith Cameron, playing Joan, cries in the elevator. And once again, we have this moment where someone walks in on her. Another New Yorker sees her in a public place, which an elevator is a public place, and or semi-public, I guess, if this building has a doorman or something. But this person sees that she's crying, or maybe sees that she's crying, but, you know, I mean, she just had this powerful moment and she's crying, but this person's like, wow, hey, I love your show, you know, you're doing so well, that review, blah, blah, blah. And she kind of has to be, she has to be kind to this person even while she just had her moment, you know, even while she's emotional. And, like all elevator rides, it seems to go on much longer than it should. I like that we get that. I think, you know, consider this commentary my argument for Lonergan's cut. Now, here's our introduction to Dave, and I will be explaining more about why I think Emily is such a great character. But I really love the Dave character in this movie. How great is him? Is he as a character? My grammar is going away. How great is he? Now, again, this scene is structured on the idea, I think, of miscommunication. Everything Dave says is either not understood or not to the liking of Emily. Emily literally will scold him for not explaining things the right way. He's trying to be clear about what the law is. He's trying to be clear about what their options are legally. We know that he's a friend of Emily's, but it's just Emily is impatient. Emily is very impatient and very direct. And the fact that she cares about someone and loves someone, because it's hinted at that they have a past, Emily and Dave, and she says, he at the end of the scene, she'll say, he used to be a very nice little boy, you know. implying that perhaps she's friends with Dave's mother or father, or perhaps she knew Dave in some other capacity when he was a kid. I don't think we ever learn exactly what Emily does for a living, and or did for a living, if she doesn't do it anymore, but she's well off, and you know, perhaps the Dave was just her neighbor or a friend. I always imagine that he's some friend of hers, and that's their kid, and she watched him grow up in a sense, and so there's a lot of trust there between the two of them. And I like that we have some color in the movie. I like that there's a black character who is, you know, frankly impressive and sidestepping every stereotype and every tendency with respect to the way blacks are sometimes cast in movies that are predominantly white. You know, he's the smartest guy in the movie so far. He knows the answers. And I like that they go into this, that they explain why this isn't a good case. It's not a good case because of a mistake Lisa made. She lied on her original statement, and that weakens the case, the civil case that they would make. And it's important that the audience hears that Emily doesn't care about money. She cares about justice. And so it's sort of the tyranny of good intentions, right? Emily doesn't care if she ruins this bus driver's life because she sees that as just, as perhaps an eye for an eye. Dave is just a neutral arbiter here. And perhaps Anna Paquin's character, Lisa, agrees with Emily on that. Dave's character is kind of a neutral arbiter, right? That's the funniest thing in the movie. In the theater, people loved this. People lapped it up. Because she tells him, who are you talking... As she just said, who are you talking to? What? You know I don't understand that. And he gets chagrined and kind of frustrated. And he says, all right, look, I'm just thinking out loud. And you can tell he's kind of pissed at her. But at this, I love the way this actor... By the way, the actor who plays Dave is Michael Ealy. E-A-L-Y? Michael Ealy. He's wonderful here. And... the way he gets mad and sort of sits and waits till he sort of simmers down before he continues, and she touches his hand and says, I'm sorry. You can tell that he's pissed off at the way Emily is treating him, but he's also used to Emily. He's also accustomed to this woman and her personality and the way she can be. And he knows that she means well, and he knows that she is fundamentally a good person, and that she's not trying to be rude to him. So he gets Emily. That's what makes the scene work for me, is the fact that they have a past, those two, that's never quite stated, but we just get the broad strokes of it. I don't like that that she's wearing sunglasses here. Maybe there's a reason in the production that she's, you know, maybe she had an eye infection that day or something. I don't know, but I don't understand why she would. I mean, this actually seems to be lit with, you know, they don't have any, you know, the light is, you know, sort of diffused, so. These scenes are often eased into. When one scene goes to the other, we saw the outside of that high school for a moment, and when we moved, I think, from the opera house to Ramon's apartment, there was the whole walk and talk with them going to the cab, and then you had scenes of New York streets at night, and then you had the outside of Ramon's building or something. This is one of the things people criticized about the movie, especially given its length, that Lonergan does this. And although I've heard people make a good case why Lonergan did that and why it's effective in the movie, I tend to agree that I don't think that kind of easing in and out of scenes in that way I think it unnecessarily adds to the movie's length, I think. I think you can cut down on a lot of that. I don't think we needed to see the outside of this high school to know that this is, we are once again in Lisa's high school, and that Broderick, Matthew Broderick, playing the teacher is teaching their English class, right? This is very high school, and college, really. I mean, someone who just interprets a passage, or gives their view of a passage, and it's just wrong. You know, it's not that there isn't some element of subjectivity and point of view in what Shakespeare means in a certain passage, but, sometimes people are just wrong, you know, as this kid is just wrong about, what Shakespeare is saying. If he want, the point is he wants to make this kid, he wants to make this point, right? He wants to say this, and he's just sort of pretending that that's what Shakespeare, or maybe he really thinks that's what Shakespeare's saying. But see, this is one of the few instances in the movie where a teacher actually does something pedagogically. Boy, Olivia Thirlby is really pretty. Where a teacher just does something that's pedagogically sound. He's a little bit cranky when he does it here, but I think he cuts him off and he says, look, that's not, you're wrong. And that's it. No, you're wrong. That's not what Shakespeare meant. Yeah, he gets a little too upset at the kid, but I think the better pedagogical move there obviously would be to I love how he pathetically takes a bite of a sandwich, because teachers often can't eat lunch. They're always supervising someone, if they're not teaching, you know, supervising a lunchroom or something. They can't really sit down and eat sometimes, especially in urban schools. But he does the right thing. He kind of says, you're wrong, and that's it. That's not accurate. The right thing to do pedagogically would have been to explain why that we know with some certainty that that theory about what Shakespeare meant is wrong. But it's a better scene if he gets agitated the way he does. This is very funny. The things Lisa says to him, these all of a sudden, you know, she can't decide as a teenager whether she's on the side of the police or not, you know. And I love that in the background, the officer who gave her a hard time is now regaling this other officer with some incident that happened, and he gets shushed, but he doesn't shut up there a moment ago, and he's just, and we actually, because of the sound mix that Lonergan provides, we actually hear what the hell he's saying. We actually hear what he's talking about, and it's sort of a similar, sounds like a similar case. Well, I guess these detectives investigate traffic stuff, right? Now, I like how Lisa's personality, too, alternates between assertive and vulnerable. You know, she's very, very cerebral and assertive, more like Emily. And then all of a sudden she can become, you know, the way she was when Ruffalo got mad at her on his porch. She can be, you know, when he asked her for the phone number, she can be all scared like that. Once again, the adults acting like simple-minded kids, and the kids acting like simple-minded adults. The whole thing, Lisa, I'm going to talk about this scene, which is extended cut material, but I think I referenced this earlier. This is the scene on Ramon's balcony. And if you really look at the kind of, not so much the composition, but the kind of way this is set up, of two people enjoying a drink on a Manhattan balcony, it's very Annie Hall, right? There's a scene in Annie Hall where I think it's after Alvy first meets Annie. They they're sort of on a porch and it overlooks Central Park West or something like that, some place like that. Yeah, see this panoramic shot we get? Like the camera just shows us what the characters see. And then it's not pointless, right? It picks up Joan again and Jean Reno enters. So it wasn't a pointless pan like a couple of the other ones we had were. I don't mean pointless, but, you know, it, the purpose of that was to pick up Joan again and continue their conversation. And the pause in the conversation allows us to think about what was being said just as they're thinking about it. Now, look, here's what I was talking about before. She says, don't you think we don't understand each other? She's being, like, very American here. You know, she's like, don't you think we should talk about this? And he's being very, he's South American, but he's being very European, even though he's a South American man, the character. He's saying, you know, I don't think, or being old school European, like, I don't think we should think about that. Why think about that? You know, why analyze it? It doesn't matter. He's telling her it doesn't matter as much as she thinks it does. If he can exist without sort of analyzing that, why can't she, you know? Her body language here is very guarded, too. It's a nice sort of piece of acting that J. Smith Cameron does. You see that arm that she has crossed across her body, that body language people will tell you that that's kind of a guarded, uncomfortable way of holding your body or sitting when you're in a conversation. She's facing him, but her body is kind of pointed slightly away from him. But that'll change as the scene goes on because, you know, well-to-do New Yorkers like Joan are used to a certain amount of irony in their lives and, a certain amount of distance from suffering. And he's talking about this charity work he does. He's a totally earnest guy, right? There's nothing to be suspicious about with this guy. He is exactly what he presents himself to be. And he's not pretending to be anybody. He's very much like Emily. He's exactly who he presents himself to be. And he has this stark approach to people and relationships. And yet he's very principled and very, you know, almost idealistic. And you see the way look at him. I mean, he's listening to Joan when she talks. When she mentioned her ex-husband, he says, "Oh, Carl." And she goes, "You remembered his name?" Yes. He's exactly what he presents himself to be. He's a nice man who is principled, who cares about the country he comes from, this developing country, who works with, you know, who uses his computer company that he owns to help this country develop and help underprivileged kids get an education, apparently is what the charity is. When he shows those pictures of his sons, it's with pride, palpable pride. And when he asks Joan those questions and she talks about her own life and how Carl gets involved with the kids, he listens to her. And you see at the end of that scene there how her body language changed. She inched closer to him and she looked at him differently while he was showing her those pictures. She's warming to him in a way that she didn't expect to. Earlier in the movie, Mr. Aaron asks Lisa, haven't you ever wanted to, you know, she says that she doesn't need to learn algebra or something. And Mr. Aaron says to her, the Matt Damon character says, well, Lisa, haven't you ever wanted to, you know, haven't you ever gotten a skill that you didn't think you needed, or haven't you ever, you know, wanted to experience something else? It's the same kind of conversation her mother has with her about opera, you know. Well, maybe I just want to experience new things and expand my horizons or some shit like that. And Lisa replies in a snarky way, but at the end of that scene with Ramon, Joan sort of, this is a beautiful sort of panorama here, At the end of that scene, Joan kind of, you see her warming to Ramon, because the reason that she didn't warm to him, it's twofold, I think. The reason that she didn't like him more at the beginning immediately, the reason she had to warm up to him, first of all, his persistence. It's sort of a good thing for guys to remember, like, persistence can pay off, but not creepy persistence, but just a, like Ramon, a very gentlemanly kind of persistence that is always very mannered and respecting boundaries. And okay, so, but the reason she warms to him, I think, is twofold. She doesn't expect to warm to him, and that's number one, right? She thinks that they are two different people from two different worlds. And the second reason is that she's able to warm, or the second reason that it's hard for her to warm to him, or it takes as long as it does, I think, is because she doesn't expect to like him any more than she does at the beginning. She doesn't expect to have that emotion that she has when they're sitting on the couch there, where he's, again, I come back to the word earnest. She's showing, he's showing her pictures of his sons. He's showing her, he's sharing his beliefs about how important it is to educate these kids in his home country, and how he's trying to do that with his company and his charity. And she looks at him a couple of times in that conversation as if, are you fucking for real? You know, are people like you for real? Are you really doing charity work without a drop of irony? Are you really, earnest? Are you really listening to me as I speak about my ex-husband? And are you really remembering his name? I mean, and in that moment, I think it's real. She really realizes that he's real. This is a great scene. Because we're laughing with Dave now. We by this time, we know Emily too by now, right? And we kind of get it. This is a nice plot turn, or a twist, that Dave was able to drudge up these internal records. As he's explaining now, the PI found these records that indicate that this guy was a threat. This guy had a history of negligence behind the wheel, and that they simply did, you know, what the Vatican does with, used to do with these priests who were pedophiles, just move them to a different position, or move them to a different shift, or parish. And so they moved Ruffalo's character to different shifts because it was a union issue. The union didn't want him reprimanded or fired or something like that. And I think it's a nice plot twist that doesn't remove us from reality. You know, it's very realistic. And here we have the introduction of Russell Deutsch. He assures us is not a sleazebag. Dave does the right thing. He says, "I can't. I don't practice this law. You need a guy." It's a cool little shot when Dave smiles at her and raises his eyebrows, because she says, "You're awesome." And he just goes, he says, "Yeah." The law is pretty awesome. You can get that kind of money. Yeah, you see how this walk and talk didn't just start with them walking. It started with that view of the building, and then the camera tilts down and we pick up Emily and Lisa here walking. And we get this background on Monica's, these people who are the beneficiaries, the only living relative, because Monica's daughter has passed, of course, and that was the daughter she was asking for as she was dying. And this walk and talk is actually, you know, for such a long movie, it actually, when it needs to give us information, it does it nice and quickly. I think I said that before, you know. I mean, she just explains that background, that these, that not only do these cousins don't give a shit, not only do they not give a shit, Monica had all kinds of issues with them. Russell Deutsch is played by Jonathan Haderi. Hadary, who is a familiar-looking face. He's not a sleazeball, Dave tells us, and he appears to be a very nice guy. Now, this is another one of those scenes where the law is being explained. And some actors, my own sort of thing is, that I've realized is that some actors are not good at this kind of scene. It's a scene where you have to be very clear and explain things and be very convincing as this person who knows the answers, as this person who's does this. And the thing is, an actor playing a lawyer doesn't practice law every day and doesn't have to explain this kind of thing every day. You see this in medical dramas a lot, where doctors have to explain things, but they explain it in this really way that is really, real doctors have to explain that stuff every day. And so they do it by rote, and it has a different kind of feel to it. And they can finish your sentences when you're about to ask a question that this is the same question they always get about it. So they answer it before you even ask it. And I find the actor there, once again, Jonathan Hadary, who plays Russell Deutsch, I find that actor really has that rhythm down and has that vibe down about a lawyer who does personal injury law, who is a good-natured man, not a sleazeball, and has to explain these things every day. And so the way he explained that stuff, you could make it a condition. You could say that. I mean, he was just very good-natured. He and the Dave character as lawyers, you know, those characters, anytime you have characters who are lawyers who play a part in a movie, I mean, they can bring a very different kind of vibe, especially if you're sort of doing the lawyer who's a sleazeball trope. But this movie doesn't do that at all. These lawyers are decent men. They both happen to be men. And the way these two actors play these parts really give the movie something really important from those lawyer characters at a good stage in the movie to do so. You know, in a movie this long, it was a good time to kind of inject some new characters who bring a different kind of energy. And it feels good, you know, when you're watching the movie. It's like, finally, somebody has some answers here. Finally, somebody knows what they're talking about. Again, all the, nothing's more annoying in a movie, especially a movie that's going for realism. Nothing's more annoying than, you know, someone turning a TV on and the news is reporting on the issue at that moment that's exactly relevant to the characters, or characters just bumping into each other all the time coincidentally. Obviously, such coincidences happen in real life, but sometimes movies have that happen 10 times, you know, in one movie. Running into you here. But, you know, in Margaret, I find that in a scene like this, every scene and the characters who are in that scene have a sensible, realistic, and real-world reason for being there. It is very sensible that a mother who's preoccupied with her own work and a little egotistical herself would nonetheless be worried about her daughter and would nonetheless want to meet Emily in this sort of awkward but mostly pleasant powwow that they have. You know what I mean? Like, the reason for that scene. I had a screenwriting teacher who used to talk about that. I know the scene you're trying to write, she would say, but, like, what is the reason for this scene? Like, in terms of, would this scene really happen in the world this story is taking place in? Why would this scene happen? Why would these people need to take part in this scene? Why would these characters need to participate in this scene? And every scene here, you know, I mean, a dinner scene, you don't see it as much, but it's completely reasonable that a mother would want to meet Emily, so the scene makes sense. That's all I mean. Pardon me. I've wondered why J. Smith Cameron, who I guess is a stage actress mostly, why I haven't seen more from her in movies. Maybe she just likes the stage better, but she's fantastic. You know, when she goes berserk, the couple times in this movie, like what we just saw, when she goes berserk, she really kind of does it in a way that's berserk, but still kind of poised, you know, because she's playing someone who is an actress. That's got to be a hard role for a professional actor, to play a role in which you're playing a self-conscious, self-absorbed actor. Because, well, it would have to be weird, too, if you really are kind of like that actor, you know. See how these, we cut outside to the yacht going by while he's interviewing, I don't know that this is a deposition, but this is an interview that he's collecting information from Monica Patterson's cousin, their only surviving relatives and beneficiaries. And we see that when you know, she didn't want to talk to Lisa on the phone about her cousin. I guess it's reasonable that she doesn't want to talk to a stranger, or she's cautious about talking to a stranger. But now that money's on the table, as Dave said, $300,000 to $500,000, all of a sudden, oh yeah, I've got phone records. Monica and I had a good relationship. When the Jeannie Berlin character tells us that, of course, that's not true. This is one of the things in which I think Margaret does engage in sort of a black and white thinking or an unnuanced kind of thinking, because these cousins, represented here by the one, the woman, Abigail, they are really kind of shallow and only interested in money. And they don't seem to really, I guess it's another example of miscommunication, though. They really don't seem to connect with the idea that Jeannie Berlin and Anna Paquin's characters are not doing this for money, and that there's a ethos going on here of justice. They want justice. They want to set a wrong right. And this sort of... it's like talking to a wall with those cousins, you know, especially in that scene later on where they have them on speakerphone. They just like never really get it. And you know, I think it'd be more interesting if, like, cause there's two, there's her and her husband, right? It might've been more interesting just if one of them like was sensitive to it and got it and the other one didn't. Yeah. Just an idea. Now, this is the scene where Jeannie Berlin's character gets set off. You know, she, given how long the movie is, she doesn't have a lot of screen time. Doesn't have a lot of lines, actually, really. I mean, she has a couple big scenes. This is one of them. But she's not the center of this movie, and yet she's what everybody remembers is Emily. Now, the quote about the world being your moral gymnasium comes to mind. This is the scene in which we're going to see it here in a moment. Oh, she's so good, Jeannie Berlin. She's going to accuse Lisa of basically, you know, well, what does she say? And we're not all just players in the opera of your life. You're a teenage girl, you know. And Lisa kind of explains how she feels about what Monica said when she died. And she frames it into this narrative about trying to twist it into meaning and trying to wring some meaning out of it in this new age way that I guess she thought Emily would appreciate. And it sets Emily off, because as much as she appreciates what Lisa's doing in helping her with the case, and you know, as much as she appreciates that, I think it's what she just said there. It means you care. Being a teenager doesn't mean you care more, because things haven't happened to you. It means you care more easily. Oh, she's so good, the way she says that. But you will be. This first blush phony deepness of yours is worth nothing. Now, that what she says there, when you get older and you don't cry every time a dog is run over, which is interesting that she says a dog run over because her friend was run over, but she was a stranger to Lisa as a dog would be, some strange dog, right? And so she says... Oh, gosh, she's so good, Jeannie Berlin. I feel so badly. You know, it's the performance that really does this. I don't know how many takes they did of this, but her performance just makes me feel so bad for this character. I like how the most strident character ever in a movie gets all haughty and angry when someone actually calls her out on being strident. Now, Lisa trying to explain herself, she doesn't know the first rule of holes, right? She shouldn't. She, you know, Emily is in a mood, and now what she says there, we're not fascinating characters we're not supporting characters in the fascinating story of your life. Ah, but they are. See, that's, I think, how this movie is functioning. You're the supporting characters in her life, and she's the supporting character, one of the supporting characters in the fascinating story of your life. And everybody's supporting characters in everybody else's life. Everybody has no choice but to conduct themselves as if they're the star of their own life. It's kind of a senseless thing that Emily says. Again, you could just watch the movie and note how many times these words actually come up. Misunderstand. I just want to talk to someone, she said, who doesn't misunderstand completely who I am. Misunderstand. Miscommunicate. Communicate. All these kinds of words along those lines. I bet they reoccur with enormous frequency in the movie. She says you're basically, to Mr. Aaron there, you're basically the most grown-up, rational man I know, which is a lie, right? Her father is pretty, well, maybe she doesn't feel she knows her dad because her dad's living far away. It's a nice touch that he's the mathematics teacher, too. Logic, rational. Rational numbers, irrational numbers. Now, after what she said to him, in the park or by the park with the whole bicycle scene, the fact that he would even allow her in his apartment is at this point negligent on his part, or foolish at least, if not in violation of some regulations that he has to follow as a teacher, right? I mean, when it comes to a student, someone goes to your apartment and you close the door, they could say that anything happened in there, and sometimes there's no way you can demonstrate that it did or didn't, and just can of worms, right? I want to talk about what I was talking about before, with the Jeannie Berlin character, and why she's so important in the movie, why she's so fascinating. She's a good person fundamentally who's trying to do right by her friend, but she's callous, strident, and she's pursuing this case, this civil case, trying to get the bus driver to lose his job, trying to get money, trying to, she says at one point, we just want to damage them as bad as we can. She's literally pursuing the case because she wants to damage the bus company, not get congruent justice, shall we say. Now, I don't think she's a very good, you know, person in some ways, you know. I think she's angry and emotional, and it's understandable because of the way she lost her friend, but it wasn't being very fair to Lisa there. It's probably, you know, there's also probably residual anger that she has with the fact that Lisa lied on her original statement. And, you know, she showed that she was angry when Lisa came and told her the truth ultimately, but she's still probably very angry with Lisa at that. And just the fact that Lisa is getting so involved in it is bound to be annoying. You know, Lisa's inserting herself into the situation, trying to, and when she began to talk about Monica in that sort of new agey way, as you know, that phony baloney way, and Emily says, well, would she go back to the spirit world, you know, which is a great line. Is she still inhabiting your body, or did she go back to the spirit world? You know, that's a great reveal that Mr. Aaron's apartment doesn't go much farther than the front of their faces, too. But, you know, what angers her about Lisa is that she chalks up all of Lisa's emotions and involvement in the case as being pursuant to her immaturity. But it's not necessarily the case. And, you know, she's being just as immature in some ways. In the theatrical cut, I believe this scene, we just, I think we see a shot from behind them in a sec, and her head goes down into his lap. And then it cuts away. It's something like that. There's a website that has the differences sort of laid out, and it goes. It sort of cuts away. But I think we get a little more action here, shall we say, or it becomes definitely clear that they slept together in a way that it's not totally clear in the other cut, perhaps. I like that question, that non sequitur comes out of nowhere. What is it like in Indiana? Again, you know, if you want to do the parallel characters or parallel structure thing, you can note the fact that Mr. Aaron is from a different place that Lisa knows nothing about, Indiana, and which is a great state, actually. It was a wonderful place. And just like her mother is dating a man who comes from a faraway place, and they seem not to be on the same wavelength. Lisa insists that Mr. Aaron understands her and that they're on the same wavelength, but they're really not. And she tells him, you're acting like a little kid. It's just sex. The Trek bike on the wall there. Yeah. Now, I don't know that the movie needs this, you know, this sort of essay question that they're reciting. It's the kind of question kids get asked in social studies classes or whatnot. Whoops. Let me just move my mic here. Yeah, it's sometimes the kind of question that kids get asked, it's almost like a Miss America question, right? If teenagers ruled the world, I don't, you know, because it's a little too on the nose, because we're wondering something along that line along those lines in terms of the whole falling out that Jenny Berlin had with Anna Paquin about, no, you care too easily. It's great writing, by the way, by Lonergan in that scene, and that scene there, the classroom scene. But to underline it with the kids in the class saying, well, if teenagers, it's just a little bit much. This is my favorite scene in the movie because it captures what the movie is for me. Not just my whole preoccupation with miscommunications and people misunderstanding each other or purposely misunderstanding something someone said or purposely trying to be opaque. But because this is such, you can see Joan, Lisa's mother, actually backing up as this Israeli-Palestinian argument goes toward its inevitable volcanic conclusion. And we listen, we have the sound mix that gives us these other conversations in the restaurant that we don't have so much of that in the theatrical cut once again. Now, I have some comments about what Ramon's saying here. that got a big laugh in the theater, too. That's my Jewish response, and Emily takes off. And the look that Anna Paquin gives her is at once, she's perplexed and fascinated all at once, you know. And he continues to say that's the Jewish response. Okay, so here's my thing with that scene. Well, it's not over yet because this aftermath is kind of part of it, right? Him explaining himself. What he's explaining here, this is exactly the way people explain themselves when they sort of put their foot in their mouth or step in shit or have a situation that was just like the one we saw, right? He says, now, look, if I'd have used the word Israeli, it would be different. That isn't what I meant. I have to tell you that I'm not... And when people do that, they're right often, in a sense. And here's what I think about that scene, you know. It encapsulates the movie, but also what he's trying to say when she gets agitated and he goes, oh, that's the Jewish response. What he's trying to say is that attitude, he doesn't mean response, right? He means that attitude, that aggressive, needlessly aggressive and somewhat incivil attitude is what he feels reflects what he feels is the attitude that the oppressors in that conflict, as he has characterized it, often have, and that's part of the problem. Now, that point is a provocative point to make at dinner, okay, with people you're enjoying dinner with. Even in a lively discussion, right? But it's not anti-Semitic. He worded it anti-Semitically. He worded it as, that's the Jewish response, as in, oh, those Jews with their horns and their, you know, their evilness, they are always going to respond that way because they're those people. It's a sort of an ethnically bigoted connotation to that, right? And that isn't what he meant. But he did phrase it in a stupid way. And he's responsible for that. And I think what's fascinating to me about the scene and the reality of how things like that really go in real life is that it captures how I think the Jeannie Berlin character, Emily, purposely misunderstood him, she purposely did not want to give him the most charitable interpretation of what he meant. She wanted, you know, she was too quick to give it an uncharitable interpretation, which was that he was saying something explicitly anti-Semitic to her face, and that she couldn't put up with, nor should she put up with, should anyone put up with. Throwing a drink in the face of someone is something I would defend. But the whole point of that scene is not that Ramon's an anti-Semite, right? The point of the scene is that, once again, miscommunication. People who are from different worlds, people who are alien to each other, not making the right hand signals and gestures to each other. We have it again here. I mean, it's almost in every scene in the film, isn't it? I like how they wanted a better lawyer, but they're getting really sound legal advice here. Now, you see what I mean here? Like, the cousin and her husband on the phone here. It's a nice scene that we get them on the phone, too. And the reason I say it, and some people would say, oh, no, why can't it be in a conference room? Why can't they be present? Why does it have to be over the phone? Why would you write a scene over the phone? But what's great is that what we just had a moment ago when Emily and... when Anna Paquin and Jeannie Berlin shot each other that look, that skeptical look or that exasperated look at how obtuse the cousins on the phone are being, you get those little nuances and those little moments when characters are talking to other characters but can't see their faces. If that makes any sense. But yeah, I still think it would be more interesting if, like, the husband understood where Jeannie Berlin and Anna Paquin were coming from, and maybe the wife was more crass about it or something. These are notoriously hard scenes for actors to handle, getting bad news on the phone. And I think... she does it about as well, and it's a weird thing too, because who is this man to her, right? She has to figure that out. As she's getting the news, she has to decide, because of the argument that happened, and because of just their relationship that was sort of moving along, progressing slowly. In that moment, when something bad happens to the person, you suddenly have to figure out. Okay, am I his girlfriend? Am I his friend? I don't know any of these people, as you're seeing here. I don't know any of these people at the chapel. You know, and just that, the weirdness of what we mean to each other in life is something that, once again, I think the movie gets right. The actor here, who plays Rodrigo, the son of Ramon, is Carlo Albán. Carlo Albán. I have to say, I don't think he exactly hits it out of the park here, quite frankly. First of all, it'd be interesting if his kid were the same age as Lisa, and this guy looks a little older. I don't know what that line's supposed to mean. I don't know if this is appropriate, but he went out a lot. But then he told me that you were the one, you know, basically is what he's saying here, you know. So what? How does that, you know, is that really that surprising to Joan? I mean, the guy was sending her flowers when she didn't even know him. I mean, which... actually, for a Broadway actress, it's off-Broadway, that she's on, actually isn't that common to get, you know, for complete strangers to send you flowers, and it's not something that happens every day. Yeah, she's stunned, and Lisa's just confused. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that actor, I guess his name is Carlo Albán. go back and watch that performance that he gives there. And it's a small part. I don't expect them to get, you know, Marlon Brando, but I'm just saying, it seems kind of wooden. Now here's, we're setting up the end of the movie here with these tickets. Once again, that moment of trying to relate to her daughter, and what's going on here on screen, I think, is when she does treat her daughter like an adult, when she does treat her like a sophisticated person and says, hey, we just experienced something that, you know, that guy Rodrigo just said something to me at the funeral. What do you make of that? What's your analysis? Let me pick your brain. And she just, Anna Paquin just brushes it off. You know, Anna Paquin says, I don't make anything of it. She says what Ramon said, you know, why do you feel like that? That line falls a little flat. I think I just feel totally at sea. I mean, it's what people say in real life, but I mean, she could express that. The fact that she needs a hug, I think we got that, right? I think we understand that she feels at sea. So having her say it doesn't really, I don't know. That's a nice jump cut, right? Just staring at the pregnancy. I mean, it's good, the performance is here, right? I mean, just staring at the pregnancy stick as if it were going to change back and show that she's not pregnant. This is an extended cut, by the way. Extended putt material. I love that. I don't know if they worked that out or if Paquin just did it, but that's great. So let me explain what I mean. Paquin does something there when she says, her mother asks her, with the pregnancy stick in her hand, she says, who's the father? And she says, it could be a lot of people, which isn't accurate from the information we have in the movie is that she slept with Paul and she slept with her teacher and we don't know of anybody else. So she's just kind of saying that. Why is she saying that? It seems to be a lie, but it is true that she might not know who the father is. Or that there's no reason for her to know who the father is, depending on the timeline, right? And her mother, when she hears that information, when Joan hears that information, she says, you know, just sort of, honey. And she sort of takes a small step toward her daughter, and Anna Paquin flinches like her mom was going to bite her when she took that step forward toward her. Just a nice bit of business, you know, just realistic, but it just says it all. You almost don't need the dialogue, you know. And the way she said, honey, when she was inching toward her, it was almost for a hug, you know. It was like, oh, sweetie, what's going on that you know, it could be a lot of people. What's happening? You know, what's going on with you? That's not necessarily the best thing for a teenage girl. And, you know, certainly from a parent's perspective. And I don't know. I love that moment. But Lonergan takes it to a whole other level when he has her say, you know, Lisa doesn't want to tell her who she's slept with for obvious reasons. And then her mother says, you're going to send that, you know, you're going to ruin that bus driver's life. You'll tell me about that, but you won't tell me about these boys. And so it kind of comes out there, you know, because early in the movie, she asked her mother about what she should do. And her mother was like, well, honey, you know, you have to choose what you think is the right thing. But then it comes out that her mother is sort of more kind of what I would probably be feeling or considering as, you know, are you really going to ruin this guy's life because he made a mistake? Are you really going to make this guy who made a mistake, definitely, and who should be responsible for it, are you really going to make it so that his kids can't eat? Is that really justice? Is that really the answer? I like that the movie allows us to think about that question, but it's not preoccupied with that question, if that makes sense to you. It's not a movie about the moral position that Lisa's in. Can you all hear me? Yes. And I like that we see that Russell Deutsch is a very good lawyer who has successfully navigated this very complicated suit in which the principals are living elsewhere and had to be flown in and deposed, in which you have this eyewitness who changed her statement, and you have this beneficiary who's actually not blood related, and he successfully navigated this suit, but now he's let the cat out of the bag that they won't discuss firing the driver because they think the union issue is that they think it will be an admission of guilt, or it will be seen as an admission of guilt, as he's saying here. Once again, the legal ins and outs of all this are explained with a nice short description or explanation that is totally accurate and totally, mostly, for the most part, comprehensive. You know, he says, she says, what is paying out $300,000? Isn't that an admission of guilt? He says, well, it just doesn't have the same stigma. Which is absolutely true. Money is not the same as apologies or admitting guilt or admitting culpability. And what they're saying on the phone is sensible, right? Like, if they're not going to fire him now, they're not going to fire him. I like that she says, I'm sorry for swearing. I like that line, just the way the whole thing is turned around on them. You know, we have the courtesy to involve you in these discussions. Now, see, I think I almost want to say there could be a missing scene, so to speak. Or, you see, Emily is puts her hand on Lisa there for a moment, almost to console her or calm her down. And Lisa gets very emotional here, and she says, what I mean is, Lisa gets very emotional, and she says, I'm the one who killed her, I'm the one who killed her. And it's this big moment she has where she can finally say that out loud, that she feels that she's somehow, and that's some of the self-hatred. The moralistic cunt line is pretty, pretty great. And then we have this big chord of opera music and this high angle. That's sort of the crescendo, you know, the emotional crescendo. But what I was going to say is that Jeannie Berlin consoles Anna Paquin, puts her hand on her a minute, but that's as she's saying, I killed her, I'm the one who killed her, I'm the one who started this all in motion. She is, in that moment, she's saying, I'm the one who caused this. I'm at the center of this. By saying it's my fault, she's saying this is my story. I'm the one at fault. I'm at the center of this. And this is my effort to put it right. But she's guilty of what Jeannie Berlin was accusing her of before, which was seeing everybody else as supporting characters and you at the center. Lisa didn't kill the guy. Lisa didn't kill Monica. She was just negligent. and that recklessness caused a death. It's not the same as killing someone, as the movie explains, as the cop explains to her. That's a weird kind of camera move there. Now, I think the implication here is that the gym teacher is involved romantically with Mr. Aaron. Or maybe, well, I mean, maybe they're just colleagues who are walking out together. And when Mr. Aaron says, who's the father? You should tell him. And, you know, he's willing to sort of, I don't want to say atone, but he's willing to sort of have her spill the beans in front of his colleague. He's, I don't understand some of what he's saying here, but I understand in a way. I don't know how we're supposed to view him. I mean, he says that you should tell the father, you should know who the, you should know who the father is, you should tell him, you should, you know, he basically invites her to out him as her, as someone who had sex with her, right there in front of his colleague and possibly his girlfriend, and she doesn't. But then he does that moralistic thing. I don't see how that matters if he cares or not or whatever. But you know, so on the one hand, he's being sort of, he's willing to take responsibility right then and there and be outed in front of his colleague as the possible father of this child, or this, this, this pregnancy that had been terminated. But, on the other hand, he gets on this like moral high horse at the same time. It's very strange. Movie pays attention to itself here. It's a, when something bad happens, they move the, we've already heard that the company moves the Ruffalo character to another shift. So it makes sense now that as they're going out to the opera at night, that he would be working the night shift. After all, he was working, seemed to be working first or second shift afternoon, when the accident happened. So it just, they call that continuity. Now, I think we're, I think in terms of extended cut material, we've seen it all. The big thing, other than, I think the two big things that are in this cut that you're not getting in the theatrical cut, to me, the two biggest differences are the more information about this abortion thing that came out of nowhere in the theatrical cut and doesn't give us any insight into Mr. Aaron or any way of understanding that scene, really, in my opinion. And then Darren, this kid who's pretty much dropped from the story, you know, that Lisa was sort of stringing along and sort of toying with his emotions. But she was, I mean, that's, she's doing that not because she's a horrible person. It's because she's a kid who's confused about her own emotions. She's called growing up. But the whole thing with him in the restaurant and the whole reason why he cries on that bed, when he calls her, to me, those are the two biggest additions. I don't think the whole exercise that the drama coach makes them do, this is a whole one-er here. I forgot that this was all one shot. The whole drama exercise, seems to me the best choice for, in terms of a big block of the movie that was effectively removed from the movie with for the theatrical cut, for the 150-minute cut, because that one is the one that you can just yank it, and it doesn't, you know, you lose the empathy for Paul, who is not an unimportant character. He's a possible father of the pregnancy, but it's the one thing that if you lose it, nothing else happens. There are certain things. It must have been a very hard movie. I haven't even discussed this yet. But it must have been a very hard movie to pare down in the way that, because Scorsese and Schoonmaker and those who were in on the editing of the theatrical cut, of the paring down of it, would have had to work from what we're watching here, the Lonergan cut that he turned in. And gee whiz, you know, as I watched, we just watched it again here, and we're in the final sort of sequence here. As I watch it, I really think, like, if I were tasked with having to do that, with having to take this 180-some-odd-minute behemoth and do whatever I could do to have it still reflect the vision of the director, but have it be 30 minutes shorter, approximately 30 minutes shorter, where would I begin in this extended cut, this movie we just watched? Where would I begin? Where would we begin? Boy, that's a hard question, you know, because I guess you would start, bring up the idea of non-negotiables again. Let me just move the mic here. Brings up the idea of non-negotiables again. What are the non-negotiables? What are the things this movie can't not have? What are the characters that can't not have? I think I would start with shorter scenes rather than trying to slice off parts of longer ones. Because the longer scene and the longer sequence, the extended sequence, is something that's Lonergan is trying to do. Well, actually, the first place I would start with would be with those establishing shots, like the shot of the high school before we go into the classroom. I would cut the movie in such a way where I would see how much time those things actually take up. That might get you 2 minutes right there, right? Establishing shots of just, you know, 10 seconds outside the high school that, you know, 15 seconds, maybe I could shave 5 seconds off Ramon and Joan walking out of the opera. Maybe there's that short, the short elevator scene was one short scene that they completely cut that wasn't in the theatrical cut. I agree with that. I think it's a great scene. And I think it has a lot of thematic heft, as I say, but, you can chuck it and still be telling the same story and still have the audience understanding that story the same way. But some of the decisions that of things that were cut in that theatrical cut, I mean, as I watch that theatrical cut again, or if I were to watch that theatrical cut again, and there's the hug at the end. If I were to watch that theatrical cut again, I think that, you know, I would do whatever I had to do to not have that complete out-of-nowhere thing with the abortion, where she just announces that she had an abortion. You don't even know if she's telling the truth or not, if that's just what she's saying to Mr. Aaron to make him feel guilty, if she's just acting out. Because in the theatrical, they sliced out that whole sequence at the clinic, where her mother takes her, goes in and sits in with her, there's a nurse there. They completely excised that. And we're rolling credits now, so I'll just finish the thought. It's really, really kind of... I see what they were doing, right? I see what they were trying to do with that, having her just say that, I got an abortion, it cost $300, and having that be completely surprising and out of nowhere, and establishing a kind of ambiguity about not just the paternity of her pregnancy, but of her reliability in terms of what she's telling one character versus another character, which is already kind of called into question by the way she treats the Darren character. But at least we know those are deceptions, you know, or we know those are manipulations. I would have done whatever I could have done to make to not have that, because I see what they're trying to do with it, but it doesn't work for me because the original, remember, you're trying to take a big cut and shave it by 30 minutes while retaining the vision of that director. And I just feel like you're inserting, and by doing that, you're inserting a world of ambiguity. I mean, it's a bold move, but you're inserting a world of ambiguity where the director had the vision was actually, well, it's not ambiguous at all. We don't know the paternity any more than the characters do, but we know she had an abortion and we know she told her mother, and that allows us to understand them in a much more deeper way and understand that hug in a much more deeper way at the end. And so I think it's incredibly important that you not insert ambiguity where there was actually, you know, an element of certainty there. But hey, like I said, very, very difficult task to have to pare down a movie like that. And I think that, I'll say at the end here, once again, if I were to recommend a way for people to engage Margaret, it would be I just want to read this credit off the screen. Allison Janneys, and I think they misspelled her last name, footwear provided by some company I never heard of. Allison Janneys footwear. I didn't know you need a whole thing for that. It's just funny. Movie credits can be so funny sometimes. But once again, it's a very hard thing to pare down a movie like that. If I had to recommend a way to watch, a way to engage the movie, it would be to first watch your theatrical cut, see, you know, how it hangs together as a movie for you, see if you like it, and then watch the extended cut, because it's much easier to appreciate the things that were taken out once you see the shorter version first. What I mean is you can appreciate the things that were taken out when you see them added in Lonergan's cut. But there was no doubt in my mind when I decided to do this movie that I had to do the cut that we just watched, the Lonergan cut, and it was a hell of a ride. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.